The West Coast markets have worked as we expected that they would work, in that they have produced, I think, the best long-term rent growth in the nation. And so I'd say we figured it out early on and chose well.
Hello and welcome to the REIT Report. I'm your host, Sarah Borks from Quito. I'm pleased to be speaking today with Mike Scholl, President and CEO of Essex Property Trust. Mike is stepping away from that role at the end of the month after 36 years with the company. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by asking you, really, what is it about the real estate industry that's kept you engaged and excited over the years? And how important do you think relationship building is in the business?
Yeah, you know, it has been quite a career, spanned over 43 years, with a few years in the beginning of my career in public accounting and venture capital, and the rest of it spent at Essex. From the very beginning, Essex and the various related companies, which included Marcus & Millichap and several other companies, had an extraordinary culture. And that culture was really developed by George Marcus, Keith Gerke, and several other very driven and talented people. I think at the time, I had just enough experience to understand how different and special the company was. And as a result of that, I actually never really thought about leaving, because I always felt like I was part of something special, and meant the world to me. I also connected with our purpose, and the need for housing has never really gone away throughout my career. And it's important systematically in the broader economy, in that cities and areas really can't grow without an adequate housing supply. And the other part is, I guess, that the industry is incredibly dynamic. It's always evolving and changing. And our mission as a housing provider can only be fulfilled through a very successful organization. There are an incredible number of risks out there that we face every day, and we need to effectively manage. And some of them, like recessions, are pretty obvious and happen systemically over time. Others are not so obvious, like a pandemic or labor shortages. And the result of all this is that we utilize a massive amount of capital, and the risk of loss in the industry is extraordinarily high. I would add that each economic cycle leads to unique challenges, and each election, new government leaders. So the environment is always changing, and we need to adapt accordingly to all those changing needs. There are an extraordinary array of issues that we deal with along the way, and we need a really strong team in order to do that. And we need a very good reputation within the capital markets, obviously at various levels of government, and even in the communities in which we serve. So overall, I'm incredibly fortunate that I have the Essex team, and we've done a very, very good job, I think, of understanding the cycles, responding to challenges, and managing risks. And that's allowed us to provide a great service to our residents while also becoming a stronger and more resilient company. So as to your question specifically as to relationship building, it's obviously a key factor in any business, perhaps even more important in the real estate industry and among REITs, given the extraordinary amount of capital that we deploy and the need for approval and compliance from the government at various different levels, the local, state, and federal levels of government. So our success depends on these relationships, and also our relationships with the investment community, and definitely our government partners. And of course, we need to provide value and an appealing housing experience to our residents. So there's no shortage of responsibility and needs. And I guess the expectation is high for a high level of service at a variety of touch points. So as a result, I would say relationship building is essential at all levels of the company. And I'd say that, I actually say this to the Essex team from time to time, that every employee is essential to the mission, because each and every employee touches something meaningful to our residents or is part of the service that we provide. And I guess that leads to maybe the thing I get greatest satisfaction from, which is working with a team of highly talented and like-minded people that are focused on achieving these goals amid all the complexity that we deal with every day, and maybe to finalize my answer, I'll say that I'm incredibly proud of what we've accomplished and for the, I guess, coordinated activity of the team and putting it all together into an organization that has served the mission, served the communities, and has accomplished a great deal over many years.
So, Mike, it must have been a difficult decision to step aside as CEO, but what do you think you'll miss most about the role? And I'd like to know really what's next on your agenda.
Yeah, that's a great question. And there are definitely some mixed feelings at play. It's difficult to think about stepping aside as a leader of this great company, and especially given the extraordinary amount of time that I've been here and the effort that I invested in the company throughout most of my life, actually, at this point in time. So at the same time, I've been here for almost 37 years and CEO for over 12 years, and it feels like it is the right time to step back. Our CEO succession plan is another super important factor. It runs for at least 5 years, and the need for orderly transition far exceeds the need of any one CEO, and especially this one. So in this case, my successor, Angela Kleiman, has now run all parts of the company in her 13 years at Essex, and she's absolutely excelled in the COO position these past few years, including she's done an amazing amount of things, including reorganizing the staff, accelerating the implementation of technology throughout the operations area, and dealing with extraordinary problems posed by the pandemic. So it's clear to me and the board that she's ready to lead the company. Obviously, these succession plans only work if everyone is committed to them, and CEOs are no exception. The greater good needs to prevail, and I think it has, certainly in this case. So I think now's a good time to step back. And as to the second part of your question, I think I need to spend more time with my family. I will note that my wife has been an amazing supporter of whatever path that I've chosen throughout my career. And I know her preference at this point in time is for me to retire. And then there's the past 3 years, which are worthy of comment. They've been, I would say, the most challenging years of my career, which of course I blame on the pandemic and the response to the pandemic. And during COVID, the leadership team's work-life balance, I think, has been stretched and perhaps stretched a bit too far. And so I think that that's a factor as well, that I hope that the only one that has suffered from maybe a little bit of burnout, and I blame that mostly on all the issues that we dealt with during the pandemic. And then there's 7 grandchildren out there, and it's super important for me to be relevant in their lives, and that requires plenty of FaceTime, which I plan to take that time in the future. And I guess my final thought about stepping down is to acknowledge the amazing opportunity that was presented to me many years ago. I was so fortunate to knock on the right door back then, and I found George Marcus and Keith Gerke, and they have taught me so much and inspired so many, including me and others on the executive team, while always leading by example with respect to how to run successful businesses. I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity, and so I have to say thank you to both George and Keith.
So, Mike, what legacy would you say you're leaving behind at Essex? And what do you consider to be some of the high points of your tenure?
Yeah, great question. Fortunately, there have been many high points and accomplishments along the way, and also some pretty big challenges as well. Focusing on the highlights, I would say 2014 was a big year for the company. It contained the merger of Essex and BRE Properties, and that was followed almost immediately by inclusion in the S&P 500. We also became an S&P 500 dividend aristocrat in 2020, and that involves raising the dividend each year for 25 years. And actually, we have raised a dividend every year since we went public in 1994. Aside from the recent pandemic years, we've also been near the top of the apartment REITs in terms of return to shareholders, I think almost every year, and pretty consistently throughout the decades as well. And we've also had tremendous growth. I was CFO when we went public in 1994, at which time we had a total market cap of $250 million, and our IPO price was $19.50 a share. Our market cap had grown to $6.2 billion by the time I took over as CEO and is now more than $20 billion. In terms of legacy, I hope to pass on the unique culture of the company that I inherited from my two very special mentors. Again, they are George Marcus and Keith Gerke. And I think largely because of that culture, we are incredibly fortunate to have so many Essex team members that believe in the company and the culture, and many of them have been with the company for decades. I find that to be something that I'm most proud of, that the long-term tenure of so many employees. And I think others have stayed with the company for much the same reasons that I'm still here. We have a collaborative culture that cares about our team members. We work hard at all levels of the organization to focus on leadership and pursuing excellence. We have a proven strategy that forms the basis of all of our major decisions, including, I'd say, more specifically, our research organization. And the rest of this is just simply hard work to relentlessly execute business plans, lots of discipline, and tireless attention to detail along the way. So as George Marcus famously says, you got to have a good strategy, but it's still only probably 10 to 20% of success. The rest of it is that discipline and execution of business plans and tireless attention to detail. So I'm incredibly proud of our ability to put all those pieces together, and the result, I think, speaks for itself.
Now, you mentioned earlier the acquisition of BRE by Essex. If you were using that deal as a case study in an MBA course today, what do you think that you would want to highlight to students?
Yeah, that was a unique series, and over many years, lots of preparation. And certainly I would think that the case study would focus on that importance of preparation and timing. And along the way, we evaluated actually many mergers, and we saw large benefits in a merger with BRE long before it occurred. I'm guessing that we ran 100 or more financial models for the BRE merger over at least a decade, and there were countless more probably involving other apartment companies, along with meetings with merger specialists on the investment banking side, discussions with other company leaders. So, but BRE was so unique because it was so synergistic with the company, because a lot of the markets were the same and our portfolios were in some cases next door to each other. So it was very unique. We did complete a private merger with a San Diego multifamily company, not a REIT, but an apartment owner, about 20 years ago. And also along the way, there were a couple of failed merger attempts with other companies. But as to BRE properties, the problem that we faced was we couldn't make the numbers work. And with respect to our acquisition and investment activities, we're all about the numbers, trying to make sure that we add core FFO per share and NAV per share. And so the question at the time was, well, should we bend some of those ideals in order to make a merger work? And fortunately, we continued to be disciplined, and we stuck to our sort of strategic rationale. And we decided to wait to see if we could find a time when the financial impact was acceptable as well. So the years went by, and we held tight to that deal discipline. And along the way, we continued to study the BRE portfolio, and we developed, I think, a really good outline and approach for a combined business plan. And ultimately, that patience and discipline paid off, and the opportunity was presented in 2014. As I recall, again, that this key issue was the merger was only slightly accretive at the time of the merger. However, as expected, we found synergies and opportunities to add value by putting the two companies together. And I do think that the two companies complemented each other in a number of ways. Partially the BRE systems, as we put the two companies together, there was a very significant number of BRE employees that took over leadership positions. And so it was truly a combining of the two entities and building something better. And maybe I probably should note that there was a little bit of luck involved too, in that there were two other likely competitors that might have been interested in BRE. However, they were in the process of consolidating the purchase of Archstone, which sold itself several months beforehand. So I think there was certainly some luck involved in the BRE acquisition as well.
I'm sure you've been asked many times over the years about expanding your footprint to other parts of the country. At what point did Essex really decide that the West Coast was where it was going to really just focus on completely?
Yeah, there's some long history here that I think I should comment on to answer that question. And I'd say long before going public in 1994, The company had investments in a variety of other places, including Texas and Arizona. And the other point is that long before I joined the company, the process of using housing supply and demand research to highlight housing imbalances was started and well underway. And that's when the strategy changed to focus on areas with housing supply constraints. So way back when, actually before Essex went public, research was viewed as a competitive advantage. And at the IPO roadshows, everyone was talking about building and buying property, et cetera. No one really talked about research as being a competitive advantage. And turns out today that everyone obviously utilizes research. So I didn't actually create that discipline. It was created before me. And obviously, we've taken it in a number of different ways since being a public company. And I continue to believe that housing supply is among the greatest threats in many markets, even as the perception of regulatory risk has increased. And definitely, it's a larger concern. You know, the reality is that capital moves swiftly to opportunity. But sometimes it involves too much capital relative to the opportunity because the people that are driving the capital are not coordinated in any way. It's different organizations that redeploy capital where they see opportunity. And sometimes you get too much capital and that leads to problems in the future. So at our IPO, the existence of supply constraints, housing supply constraints, was only something that were available in a few markets, and mostly I'd say either the East Coast or the West Coast. And back then in the early 90s, there were probably almost 40 multifamily REITs that went public. And we were the only REIT that talked about the risk of too much housing construction. Obviously, that's something that's changed and everyone is talking about that today. Maybe it will help to note that we have tried to expand to the East Coast on a couple of occasions. We ultimately chose to focus on the West Coast, primarily because we saw the tech communities as such amazing innovators and wealth creators, and the concept of owning apartments in areas that have incredible wealth creation and innovation essentially led to the creation of high-paying jobs, which are absolutely ideal for apartment ownership. So as a result of all those factors, the West Coast markets have worked as we expected that they would work, in that they have produced, I think, the best long-term rent growth in the nation. And so I'd say we figured it out early on and chose well. Maybe there's a couple of unique advantages on the West Coast that are worthy of note. I will just hit these things very quickly. The first, of course, is limited housing supply. And that is super important. You can't have a situation where too much capital can be translated into lots of housing in a very short period of time, because that definitely interrupts the supply-demand relationship. Along the West Coast, it's notable that we produce less than 1% of existing stock each year in terms of housing. So it never produces a lot of housing, and therefore it's more difficult for it to become oversupplied. And obviously, the second key ingredient is demand drivers. We realize that the cost of living is higher in California and Washington, and so wages need to be higher. And growth in incomes is super important because you can't have rent growth without wage growth. They have to work together. And so I think that the process of creating new successful companies is important in the overall equation, because those companies, again, they generate wealth and they generate higher incomes. And that, I believe, continues to be just as exciting today as it was 50 years ago. And apartments, you know, continue to ride the coattails of all these successful companies. So our belief is that that unique composition of the markets out here is something that probably isn't going to change anytime soon. And finally, the limited housing choices that are available on the West Coast, especially this transition from a renter to a homeowner, is incredibly difficult. And that makes people that live here renters for a longer period of time, which is also beneficial to the housing markets. In terms of plans going forward, the expansion of tech companies to other markets has required our research process to also evolve. And so we now consider a larger number of major metro areas in our research effort, you know, currently about 25 major metros across the country. And as time has gone on, we believe that some of these areas are beginning to look a lot like the West Coast markets, let's say a couple decades ago, with respect to some of these key dynamics of a robust and good housing market. So I would note a couple things. Limited, less housing supply, more costly for sale housing are a couple of the key considerations there. So I think it's very possible that Angela and her team going forward will pursue geographic expansion at some point. Still, it's only been a year since the West Coast opened up from the pandemic. You know, hard to believe that it stayed with us as long as it did. And so we still believe, given the impact of the pandemic and rents on the West Coast, we still have a lot of recovery ahead of us. And so I think for the moment, we're happy to stay in our existing markets. So maybe a comment on the Sunbelt markets. There's definitely been strong rent growth in the Sunbelt markets over the past several years. And that has definitely led investors to ask more frequently about geographic expansion. I want to note that the Sunbelt markets generally did not shut down during the pandemic. And in effect, I think they were the beneficiary of California's outward migration when California and Washington, to a bit lesser extent, forced the massive job losses early in the pandemic. And I guess the easy money policies during the pandemic contributed as well, and specifically to the Sunbelt success. However, things have changed dramatically on the capital front, and with all the capital flowing to the Sunbelt in that period of time, I'd be somewhat concerned that it's going to overdo its housing supply, and that could change things relatively quickly.
So Mike Essex has developed a data-driven culture under your leadership. Do you think that such an approach is really vital to success these days?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. George and Keith in the 1980s really started that, and they were looking for an advantage, like how do we deploy capital more effectively? How do we find opportunity based on supply-demand relationships? So they started an effort in the early 80s. It was a time when good data to quantify housing supply and demand was difficult, if not impossible, to find. Today, we have an abundance of market-related data, although much of it is nuanced or conflicting or too narrow to be useful. So an abundance of data, but it is hard to interpret. And I give our people great credit because we have people on our research team that truly understand the data, where it comes from, and what it means. So I'll give you as an example, perhaps. Today, our research to quantify housing supply and demand relies mostly on our own internal research with respect to apartment supply in our various submarkets across the West Coast. And our research team either goes out and does property visits and or use aerial photos and other similar techniques to do our own fundamental research. And you can say, well, that apartment supply data is available. Why do you do your own research on it? And the answer, of course, is that we found the existing data sources unreliable. For example, apartments are generally delivered in phases, and sometimes the third-party data sources count the same building twice as it's delivering different phases over multiple years. So we found it to be unreliable, and so we've created our own effort to make sure that we have the best data available with respect to apartment supply deliveries. But we've also found opportunities to make better pricing decisions internally by implementing our own proprietary and built by the company revenue management system. So we rely to a much greater extent on our own unique data sources as it relates to that activity. And so we have essentially disconnected one of the older and more generic systems that is offered commercially. And we built a revenue management system that's synergistic and really directly related to our new operating model, which is rather than have each apartment property represent its own business unit, we now manage nearby communities from one centralized location as one business unit. And that results in operating efficiency and our ability to offer a broader inventory of available Essex apartments to meet the specific needs of our residents. So we found that aligning the revenue management and it using our own system and our own data to do that was much more beneficial than using the commercially available product. So bottom line, we think better data is a huge competitive advantage, and it remains part of the strategy. And we spend considerable time and effort thinking about it and trying to innovate as it relates to utilizing good data to drive our decision making.
Mike, how would you describe the current macro outlook for the multifamily sector? And what do you see as some of the key issues that we'll be facing in the coming years?
We're at a time where when the macro outlook is probably as unclear as it's been for most of my career. And every year we prepare our own forecast and we start that effort by using the consensus of leading economists for the U.S. economy and then try to translate that into what it means for the markets in which we're invested. So we published that in the fourth quarter and we expected a mild recession, which was mostly based on minimal U.S. GDP and job growth. Based on that outlook, we're actually pleased that 2023 rental revenue will grow at a historical healthy pace, partially because carrying forward some of the strong markets that we had last year into 2023, along with more muted market rent growth. But I would say that there are some storm clouds maybe on the horizon in the form of higher interest costs and inflationary pressure that will impact certain expense categories. So we think that, again, this year will evolve and our insight into how it's going to play out, I think, is a little bit impaired relative to most normal years. At this point, being a couple months into 2023, we are pleased that the economy has been more resilient, especially with respect to job growth. We expected job growth to drop off more significantly than it has. And so that leads to maybe some good news. However, it's unclear how this is all going to play out for the rest of 2023. If the Fed's response requires continued small increases in interest rates, and you would conclude that maybe the worst is behind us. So I would say that while it seems like resilient labor markets is a good thing, it's unclear how the Fed will respond to that environment. Hopefully, their response is for continued small increases in interest rates as we continue through 2023, and that would definitely support a more positive outlook. However, it's also possible that inflation will prove to be stickier and it's at too high a level, and that will require more interest rate intervention by the Fed. So that concerns us, and essentially we don't have a particular theory about how that's going to play out. We'll just have to wait and see. Well, obviously, this is not a West Coast or a tech-specific issue. It affects the entire multifamily sector, and I think that we'll see moderate growth in 2023. Hopefully, and especially in markets that are seeing some elevated supply and slowing job growth may be affected to a greater extent. I think the biggest challenges facing the multifamily industry will be supply related and perhaps a regulatory environment as well.
So Mike, I wanted to also ask you about housing affordability, which, as you know, is a huge topic across the country these days. What do you see as some of the potential solutions to deal with this issue?
You're right. That is a huge issue across the country. And I think different areas have done maybe a better job than the West Coast at dealing with it. Overall, I think the solutions to housing shortages have been too simplistic. As state and local governments need to do more to balance the costs of housing and the things that are required of housing developers with incentives on part of their housing development policy. So I guess what I'm suggesting here is that housing investments involve massive amounts of investment capital, and that capital flows seamlessly across geographies to the highest return and the lowest risk opportunities. And certainly we've seen more recently the flow of this capital to the Sunbelt markets and away from the coastal markets. And again, that will have an impact on how much multifamily construction will be built in the foreseeable future. And there'll be much more of it in the Sunbelt markets. And there will be a substantial underinvestment likely in the coastal markets. Again, one would suspect that that will lead to continued shortages in the coastal markets and perhaps overbuilding in the Sunbelt markets. Part of this is there are fewer politicians today that really understand the dynamic of, again, massive amounts of capital needed to fund housing constructions. And they somehow, I think, overly simplistically believe that that capital will just be there. And politicians often seek to help one group, generally renters, at the cost of investors and landlords. So they often miss the reality that capital is mobile and lower yields deter investment. So I'd say in California and Washington, a good example of this is the ever-increasing mandates for low-income housing units as part of development projects. I think it's an admirable effort to promote greater affordability throughout the marketplace, but it comes at a price. And the higher that price, the less likely we are to be able to make projects pencil. And again, if you don't have an adequate return, the capital will go elsewhere. And so that understanding that dynamic, I think, is key to understanding why we have supply issues in California and why they're so pervasive and difficult to address. I guess the unintended consequence of this approach is to impair the viability of development. On our side, you know, we have trouble finding investors. And again, the more recent experiences, most of the investors that we work with, beginning maybe a year and a half ago, essentially exited the West Coast. And they are definitely deploying capital elsewhere, but there will be very little investment on the West Coast. That will be a key issue and potentially opportunity as we think about our markets going forward. And so back to what we can do to make things better, you know, I guess there's an educational part of this in that we need to share with the local governments some of the issues that we have seen and share with them some of the things that other areas of the country have done a better job of in terms of creating incentives to offset those costs to create improved viability of housing projects. We've seen, again, a number of these historically, and I'll give you a partial list here. For example, low-income housing tax credits, various types of property tax abatement programs, muni bond financing, and there was a program that combined muni bond financing with a 30-year credit enhancement that was offered through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac before, many years ago, that was incredibly effective at making housing investments pencil. So I think that, again, it starts with the local government leaders understanding the costs of their policy and then trying to find ways to offset those costs with, generally speaking, tax incentives and or financing incentives and to have a more balanced program. And with that, I think that we can solve some of the housing problems on the West Coast.
Great. And bringing the conversation back to Essex, what are you most excited about for the company's future?
Yeah, we still believe very much in our mission. And even though the last few years have been incredibly difficult and we have had problems that we've never seen before, we still believe most of those relate to the pandemic and the government's response to the pandemic, including these incredibly complicated and restrictive eviction moratoria that are finally coming to an end. This has been an incredible burden for the company and to process through and manage this environment and at different levels of the system as well, you know, including, for example, the courts are completely backed up in terms of dealing with some of these issues as well. So on the demand side, we are super excited about what continues to evolve. And the tech companies go through this process of reinvention that seems to never end. And I think they're doing it once again with respect to the investments in artificial intelligence, which are growing rapidly, and they're heavily concentrated in the tech-driven markets, especially in Northern California. So we think that that will drive another leg in the growth in the economies in especially Northern California and Seattle. And more broadly, that will help the company, help Essex continue to grow as it has much over the last 30 years or so. I think that return to office, which is likely in a hybrid model going forward, will continue to be a long-term tailwind for the West Coast because we suffered the negative impact of it during the pandemic. And I think that there will be a slow return to office. More and more CEOs seem to be indicating that, you know, going from 2 days to 3 days in the office is going to be important as they try to tackle some of these really complex problems that are part of AI and other projects that they're working on. And this all comes at a time when supply will continue to be muted. Again, I pointed several times to the lack of investment or underinvestment in the West Coast, which has always led to a period of time where demand may exceed supply for some period of time. So I think that's potentially ahead of us over the next several years. I'd say coming out of periods of disruption, we've always been an opportunistic company. We've always found the right investments at the right in the right place. And I think this is the case today. And so I think the company remains in a strong position. And certainly our balance sheet is incredibly strong. We've got great liquidity. And we have a very capable executive team led by Angela Kleiman.
Great, Mike. So we've covered lots of ground today, but is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, maybe in closing, I didn't get here all by myself. I mean, there was an incredible number of people that helped me along the way. And I think it's super important to recognize and thank them for all the help. My view is this has been an enormous collaborative effort involving all kinds of incredibly wonderful people. And certainly I'll start my list of gratitude and thanks to my leadership team, and especially Angela Kleiman. I have to give a shout out to my wife, Josephine. She's been an amazing person. She is an amazing person. Has been incredibly supportive, especially with all the travel and nights away and other things. She's been there for me in every conceivable way. That's been great. And, you know, I want to thank everyone else out there, all the constituencies from the investment community, certainly the relationships that fostered along the way. It's all made this incredible company what it is, and it means so much to me. So thank you all.
Mike, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you guys doing this.
And to our listeners, if you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.